What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Welcome to Department of Homeland Security, the officially unofficial podcast for The Boys on Amazon Prime Video. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 2, Episode 4, titled Nothing Like It in the World. Aaron, what did you think of this episode?
There is certainly nothing like The Boys in the world.
That's true. Yeah.
The stuff, the fucked up stuff they get up to with the doppelganger character.
My God. Yeah.
It's, you know, I my mind goes through the gamut when he lands and goes in that cabin and she's there. I'm like, is this some kind of robot that Vought has constructed? Stan Edgar's ace up a sleeve? Is it some genetically engineered thing? Is he having a psychotic break?
Sure. Dream sequence. She didn't really die. This was, she like had a clone that he killed to make it look
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's the simplest answer is the one that ends up being correct, is like, oh, there's another soup. That's a classic superhero power, be able to, you know, to mystique it up. Mm-hmm. And he's got this schlubby middle-aged mystique that he's, he's bullying into being his sex mommy again.
Yep.
I thought it was a good episode, and there's a lot of like well-crafted narratives in like people being forced to make parallel decisions, like Butcher's wife Becca having to go her separate way because Billy can't handle having a superpowered child. Yeah. And you know, that also mirroring Starlight's having to go her separate ways from Huey because it's so dangerous what they're doing. And they're both similar because they, like, you know, they have this kind of like connection, this intense connection before the very intense disconnection. I thought it was pretty nice. It's pretty nice mid-season, kind of like over the hump plot. What did you think?
Yeah, I really like that stuff with Starlight and Huey. I think that one scene where they kind of lay out all the pressures they're living under, right? Like, oh, here's, you know, they're comparing their stress peens, right? Like, here's what I'm living under. Oh, yeah, here's what I'm living under. And Annie's just like, I feel like there's a loaded gun pointed in my face every single day. And how this road trip has given her a slight reprieve from that, right? She doesn't feel that pressure. And like, it says so much about like how good they could be for each other if they weren't in this completely fucked up situation. And it's sad in some ways. It's delightful to see in others. And like, I'm really connecting with those two characters now. And the rest of it, I mean, like the deep stuff is kind of hilarious as it has been. And I do wonder where they're going with that. I think, you know, as someone with who is familiar with the cult life, let's say, I feel an intense like dread over what's coming. What I know, like I can see all the mechanisms at work here, right? Like these control mechanisms. It's so fucked up. And I know that he's just digging in deeper and deeper here with every step. It really sets off alarms in my head, and it's great. The Butcher stuff, I guess I didn't think I would care much about like Butcher's reuniting with his wife, because Butcher is a character that encourages you not to like him in a lot of ways, or not to really want to see him super happy.
Yeah, he is kind of like this antagonist protagonist. You're broadly, because like when Becca was running down all the reasons that she can't go back into a relationship with him, it makes absolute sense, you know. Yeah. Like everything she's leveling as an accusation, and he just doesn't get it. Like, they've lived a very different life, had very different priorities the last 10 years, and it shows. And I also like that they're starting to flesh out, like especially Mother's Milk this episode, Marvin.
Yeah.
But given Frenchie, I was shocked at his like drug, you know, self-destructive drug use this episode. Like that's just like his go-to. I don't remember if they established that, in season one, or if he's just in a lot, and like how, I guess they've done a pretty good job of showing that he's fairly emotionally immature. He's very childlike in a lot of ways. And yeah. you saw that in full display this episode, like some of the mistakes he makes. I get Huey. He just drives me fucking crazy, man. His inability to be like emotionally honest, and the few times when he tries to walk it back because, oh God, I overshared or whatever.
Right. It's, he starts feeling self-conscious about it. And
yeah, it's not unbelievable. It's just annoying, you know, legitimate in the same way that, like, I guess it could be annoying to watch, you know, Don Draper do self-destructive things on the mat. It's not that you hate watching him or whatever. It's just, I'm half the time watching his scenes with Starlight, like, with, you know, hands in front of my face, peeking out between fingers, like, oh my God, what is this horror show?
Being pulled in two directions, right? He's got Annie, who's trying to pull him over toward expressing everything to her, right? And he's got Butcher, right, who's saying, shut that shit down, you're weak, we don't have time for this bullshit. Like,
sure.
He's trying to be both of these people in two different scenarios, and it's tearing him apart.
Especially since, like, I feel like Starlight is the type of person you could level with all the time, you know? Like, yeah. She seems like she's remarkably well-adjusted for the upbringing she's had and the experiences that she's gone through. So it's like watching him play these weird games, and she's just not, like, it's like watching someone trying to play basketball against the other person just standing on the court. Like, what's all this dribbling going on?
Yeah.
And he's just, I don't know. There's something really pathetic about him too. Baby Huey here.
Yeah.
If they're going to pivot into John Connor, I'm just very curious to see if they give this guy a spine. If he's going to get a spine, and it'd be hilarious if it was actually a physical, like he gets a cyborg spine, you know, a literal spine injection. But it's like, yeah, he's just kind of like a boneless fish. Early season,
he injects Compound V, and it just gives him a really hard spine.
Yeah, gives him an adamantium backbone, and that's all he needed. That's all he needed. Yep.
I actually went back and watched one of the episodes from season one, where Homelander was confronting Starlight about, you know, fraternizing with the enemy here with Huey, and just his dismissal of Huey as this weak, ineffectual person. And yeah, I mean, Huey has definitely been that in the past, and I think this season he's trying to step up. That whole thing, I think, was, you know, a wrench was thrown in that when Butcher showed back up and just started being the daddy again. But like,
yeah,
at some point there has to be a real confrontation between them, right? Something where Huey steps up and either comes to terms with being the beta here in this relationship, whatever, or expresses like, look, you're out, I'm in, this group needs me more than it needs you, you're harming us more than helping. I don't know.
They might be setting that up now, because Butcher has once again left the team for pursue his own. And it's wild, because I thought the language they're telling the last episode was him putting that to the side. I guess, and but maybe Becca, he was, but like, then Colonel gave him, he's like, okay, well, yeah, I guess I'm going to, you know, try to help the other. And then the Colonel just gave him. So that all tracks.
Uh-huh.
But I think, you know, it was portrayed by Mother as like a betrayal.
Yeah.
Huey's already over him. And Frenchie, if he ever cleans out and recognizes a betrayal as well, it'll be interesting. Yeah, I can see the pieces. It's just the big piece in the middle. Huey needs a spinal transfusion, something.
I guess that's the thing. Like, as Becca points out in this episode, you know, he's on a path. He's got patterns that he falls into. Butcher does, and I wonder if Mother and Frenchie and Huey are going to see that. Like, because he does. He leaves. He comes back when it's convenient for him. He's there when it's not. He's gone. Like, that's a pattern that he's falling into, and I wonder if they're going to let him get away with it for much longer.
Are you rooting? Are you rooting for Starlight and Huey to be together?
Yeah, yeah.
Are you really?
I feel like a dipshit for rooting for it, but yeah.
Because I can't tell if like I'm on guard, because I feel like this is the type of show that might kill one of these characters, like you know, Game of Thrones style in season three to be shocking, because it's got that DNA. So like, I'm not sure if I'm just not, or if I think Starlight and Huey could be to do better, You know, like Huey, this is the definition of a rebound relationship for him, right? Yeah. Like it's like he's still grieving the tragic loss of his girlfriend, and you know, he's now this like a very impressive, beautiful woman has taken an interest in him. Is, you know, this the actual thing he needs in his life, or is it the thing in front of him that he can't say no to? And for her, yeah, what is, like, how in the world is Huey, I guess even though he's a mere mortal, he's embroiled in this superhero politics stuff, so maybe he can't understand the like life and death shit the way a lot of people wouldn't. But you know, she's doesn't have a lot of relational miles under her belt too. So just from a human storytelling perspective, it's highly unlikely, it seems to me, that these two would end up together, setting aside tragedy. So, but
yeah, and if they continue on the path they're on, you know, Hugh has got to be more honest with her. Like that's all she's really asking from him, is just be honest with me. Don't hide shit. Don't try and protect me. And everybody's telling him that, right? Like she's a big girl.
Right.
Take care of herself. She's a bigger girl than you are a boy. So fucking treat her like it. Right. And
yeah.
I don't know. Hugh is somehow reluctant to do that. He thinks he's protecting her by keeping her out of this, which.
And I think it's also his insecurity, right? Like if he's honest with her, then she'll know that he's not special and that he's clingy and emotional and all this. Like if he's honest about it, then she's in love with the fiction that just she's worked up in her mind about him, and he's worried about being exposed. So yeah.
I don't know. I like this episode. It's not as like thrilling from the Homelander Vought Stan Eggers kind of angle that I really loved about last episode. But we'll
probably
get back
smart
to that,
from
I'm sure.
Probably smart from a pacing perspective to like give that battle royale a little bit of space to breathe, or even like throw Stormfront in.
Uh-huh.
That might be. Is it possible to Stan Egger? That's his plan. Is just to have Homelander embroiled in a useless power struggle within the Seven that keeps the focus off of him, so he can do the behind the scenes maneuvering to continue to put Vought on top.
I mean, that's what I was thinking last episode. There's a new wrinkle here with Stormfront potentially being Liberty, the long time.
Didn't see that coming. Superhero. Did not see that coming.
No. So there might be more to it now that we know that information. But yeah, I do think Edgar, part of Stan's plan is to keep Homelander distracted, not let him get involved in the power politics that are playing out on the global scale, right?
Yeah, just keep it all about the boys' club.
Yeah.
That Stan doesn't give a shit about.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's get into the recap. We start off with a woman being interviewed, and she tells a story about getting engaged to a man whom she didn't realize wanted to remain childless. And she called the wedding off when she found out, and she thinks that communication is the key to a healthy relationship.
I thought these were so fucking mysterious the first time I watched this. Like, what is this? Like, is it going to be a commercial for superhero dating? Mm-hmm. Or what is the deal? And I still have a lot of questions, but it was an interesting kind of like mystery that it was like, second time in a row where I fire up the Amazon software and like, God damn it, is the catalog. What is this? Is this desperate housewives dating on the internet? Like it's slightly filmed differently. It's a completely different thing. And it put me off balance as a viewer right away, which I think is kind of cool. But they're also a little bit of comic relief because, you know, some of these women seem like they're nightmares.
I mean,
some of the men that they're talking about are definitely nightmares.
Absolutely. By the end, when you understand, okay, these are relationship auditions, essentially, it puts into perspective like what the church wants for the deep, I guess, right? Here she's talking about communication being the key, and they don't really care about the communication between the wife and the husband here. They've got some other things in mind, and we'll talk about those when we get to the particular scenes. But this is not the woman that he is going to end up with, we'll just say. Mm-hmm. So then Frenchie gets blasted out of his mind on Coke. Coke looked like Coke to me. And he kisses Kimiko while she's seething about the death of her brother, which not a good idea. She rebuffs him with a hand to his throat and he runs off.
Yeah, partially crushed windpipe.
Yeah,
good way to shut that shit down.
I saw here on the news that her brother is being blamed for the death of the people in this apartment building, which, of course, that's how the Seven would spin it, how Vought would spin it.
This deadly, dead-eyed foreign terrorist remorselessly killing all these, you know, hardworking Americans. That's the infuriating thing. Like, this team, just everyone gets drugged through the mud.
Hmm. And these scenes with Kimiko and Frenchie are really just like setting stuff up for the future, because there's not much in this episode for them. We're just kind of learning how Frenchie feels about this whole situation, and Kimiko's angry, which obviously.
Yeah. And it's wild because we don't know much about Frenchie, and like this relationship has all been surface, and it still feels like very surface level.
Yeah.
And we did find more about Frenchie, but it seems to reinforce that, like, he's just infatuated this girl and doesn't really give a shit about what she needs or wants. It might be his arc that he kind of matures and sees her as an actual person. But, you know, we took a lot of this stuff as benign in the first, you know, that he's like, you know, looking after her and like one of the few members of the team that gives a shit about her one way or another. But it's been revealed this last episode or two that that's kind of been a self-centered concern.
Yeah, and I think that's good color.
To do about her as a person. Yeah,
They're putting some decent color on this character now after, you know, a full season of nothing from him. I'm looking forward to what they do, but they don't do any of it here, right? Like, they're just saying, they're setting the state of Frenchie, which is he is a man child who's got something that he needs to deal with about his guilt over her brother and like all the people that have died. I don't know his role in this whole thing. He's got to come.
The thing they needed to do is disabuse us of the notion that Frenchie's just a good guy. You know, he's just a good guy. He's like he seems like he's the best of the boys, right? And they kind of reveal that, you know, when you peel his layers back, he's got a lot of fucked up shit going on under the hood too. Mm-hmm. So it's gonna there's clear lines of growth for all these guys, and I can't wait to see them go down it.
All right, Homelander is watching Stormfront and seething over her press. She's arranging a protest against Vought. On the news.
She's eschewing the multi-million dollar patriotic commercials and going just doing personal appeals, late woman on the street.
Which, you know, if you're Stormfront, you've got to be questioning why Vought's letting you do this on their official channels. Why they're keeping you in the Seven. How much do you think she's in on this? Is this a plan with Stan?
Yes, that's my working theory, is that, she went away to cover up some stuff. She's this powerful super they had on the bench, and he needs someone to contain Homelander. She needs a fresh start. But it's also I'm curious to see, because she's old. She's real old, and she's playing a very young, hip, very deeply racist person. I'm curious to see how they. It's almost like Shades of Twilight, you know, that you've got this 17-year-old boy who actually is a Civil War veteran or some shit. You know, it's like, what's it like to be in that kind of cover? You know, that like you're born in 1920 and you're racist because you're born in 1920. But now you also have to have all the, like, you got to be up on Periscope. Like, imagine an 85-year-old grandma that's brand as being sexy and anti-consumer on Periscope and Twitter and shit like that. Like, that seems like that'd be something to be annoying at, to say the least, or hard to do.
I mean, you lived through the Great Depression. And now here you are making sure you get hearts on Periscope.
I think it's interesting. And I do. What do you think? You think she's in deep?
Yeah, I mean, she has to be.
There's no way Vought doesn't know, right? Vought has to know she's Liberty. They made her.
Vought absolutely has to know. They put her in this position for a reason. And it seems like
top level, this is a top down decision.
Absolutely. Yeah. Stan put her in there personally. So he understands, he's got to know who she is. Right. Both as the superhero Liberty, from the past, but also her stance on the Vought Corporation and that she's going to get in there and mix shit up with their public image. That's part of what he's trying to do. And whether he's just trying to keep the Seven occupied while Vought goes about their business, or whether it's something more, I don't know yet, but it remains to be seen.
Yeah.
I love the shot that they give us when Homelander is watching her on the news. It's like shot right past his leg as he's like tapping it furiously, right? He's like,
yeah.
Sitting there. Oh, he's so angry. And you see the leg energy. And past it, her on the news. And it's really good. Then he flies off to this cabin where Madeline Stilwell, who I'll remind you was murdered by him last season.
In graphic style.
Very graphic, unmistakably murdered. There's no chance she survived that. Welcomes him to this cabin with a warm glass of milk and a makeout session. And this is a profound what the fuck scene. Like you mentioned in the beginning, you see this and you're like, okay, there are 50 scenarios I can think of where this could happen. What would the boys do here? And I'll admit, I was kind of a dumbass when it came to this scene. I was thinking, God, clones.
Same.
We're in a fucking superhero film, like series. Shapeshifting is a thing that superheroes do all the time. That should be a number one on my list. It was nowhere on my list.
I know, like the idea that this is some kind of mystique, kind of a Clayface figure. And what's wild is I'm watching Harley Quinn, the anime series on HBO Max, which has Clayface as a major character, and he's transforming people all the time. Like, why? Why the hell did I not make that connection?
I feel like if they're doing such a good job of connecting me to some of these characters and the intrigue that's going on with the business and the public image,
I just forget my mind is laboratory.
Watching a superhero show half the time, right? Like, oh fuck, of course there would be 100,000 other people who Vought has experimented on who have various ranges of powers. I just get stuck in like, oh, Translucent and Homelander and Starlight, and these are the power sets. No, they're all over the place.
And especially, it's what's really great is like this kind of reinvents this kind of Oz prison bitch relationship where, like, you know, this gang of a prison boss has his favorite twink that he tattoos tits on their back, like forcing this dude to be this other thing. And they established that it's like extremely painful, but he's got to do it because he's going to ask politely. And when they review, because I'm thinking, okay, it's a laboratory robot manipulation, psychological thing. When it's just some dude that's being abused by Homelander, then the second time it rolls around, the stakes are much higher. And like the desperate tactics are like, I was goddamn was on the edge of my fucking seat the second time they had their meetup. But pulled one over.
Absolutely. We won't see any more of this guy. Obviously, he's dead.
No, he's going to hunt down another shapeshifter and make him assume doppelganger as Madeline.
Oh, God. But I did appreciate the twist where, like, it's painful to hold that form for a while because they don't usually do that.
Yeah.
Right?
It's like sucking in your gut. Like, you have to hold these muscles in a certain way. And, like, it's like trying to keep your arms above your head for an hour. It's just hard to do.
Yeah. All right, Butcher meets Grace to tell her that they've run out of leads on Raynard's killers, and she gives him the next clue, which is an address where Mother's Milk can go to ask about Liberty. Grace also gives him the location of Becca, even though he couldn't hold up his end of the bargain.
It's interesting, like this Colonel character, that she's got this... all these ghosts following her, all the normal people have been killed by Supes, and she envisions it in this massive crowd in Carnegie Hall, and they're all looking back at her. And I thought is kind of poignant because it did feel like a plot shortcut, but I buy it. Like, you know, she's at the end of her life. She's got a bunch of regrets. She's an arch manipulator, and she's manipulated this guy kind of like hijacked his life for a decade. And she's at the end of her life, she's feeling real bad about it. Mm-hmm. So she doesn't want another pair of eyes staring back at her. I thought that this is a really good scene, and Carl Urban and the Colonel here did a nice dance.
Yeah. Yeah. Well constructed scene. I sometimes just appreciate the construction of the writing and how it loops back in on itself. Homelander and Madeline watch Taxi Driver while he vents his frustration about being usurped by Stormfront as the face of the Seven. She suggests that he thin the Seven herd, And then Madeline morphs into a shape-shifting soup named Doppelganger. Homelander demands that Doppelganger change back, even though it's very painful.
Yeah. And I also, because like, I remember the first time I was watching this, like, I start, like, Madeline is very flirty and available at the beginning, but she, there's something about her looks strained as the scene went on. Like, and I was trying to think, like, are you getting bored of Homelander? Are you finding this tedious? Because holy shit, if he catches on, you're going to be dead. And when he just turned in his middle-aged dude, I was like, what the fuck? Such a great, like I said, I was wide open for the haymaker, it landed. And then it's like this, what the fuck? And then I felt really bad for his doppelganger, and you know, God, fuck Homelander, man. What?
Oh yeah,
what, I mean, a terrible
kind of guy that would see something redemptive about Taxi Driver, like,
right?
About the main character.
He's like, I can't wait to hear his crazy ideas about like Fight Club, you know, like, or he's Scarface, one of those ones that they watch the movie and get all the wrong conclusions from it. But I thought that was like, when I saw that they're watching I was like, oh my God, can you imagine sitting down this psychopath, you're trying to get him calmed down and feed him milk, and he's like, let's watch Taxi Driver. Oh fuck. You know, you don't want to do Babe. No, you don't want to do Babe or the Muppets movie, something like that. You want, okay, Taxi Driver. All right, sure. Falling Down. Yeah, something relaxing.
Why not? So then MM tries to talk Butcher out of leaving the group to go off to find Becca on his own. Butcher promises that MM will get his family back if he just follows up on this Liberty lead. And he's not saying goodbye to the other boys, which none of this is sitting right with MM. You know, the Butcher leaving again, Butcher not saying goodbye to the rest of the team, like all of it just feels wrong to him.
Yeah, and when he tries to do the bro shake at the end and Mother's Milk does, but it's very unconvincing. And it's nice because, like, I don't think Mother's Milk necessarily expected him to be the bigger person, say goodbye to Huey, but the Frenchie feels like a betrayal, and like, yeah, oh well, you know, he's blasted off his mind and drugs, feels very thin to MM here. And yeah, they sold all that for sure.
Yeah, none of it's great. It makes me wonder what kind of greeting he'll get if he returns a second time.
Well, also, if Mother's Milk does this milk run and gets his family back, there's also the idea that, like, why are the boys the boys?
Yeah.
Like, they were kind of thrown back together circumstantially, and they all had different, you know, they all have now very different win conditions, and some of them are probably going to, like, when Mother gets his name cleared and his family out of danger, why wouldn't he? Like, some of the stuff later on where he's talking about, like, him becoming his dad having a disease that he's caught, and if he doesn't watch, he's going to pass it on to his kids. Like, he's talking about him dying. Mm-hmm. Like, there are no old, bold, anti-soup dudes, you know?
Yeah.
and he's feeling that, and you know, as someone who his dad's death put him on a trajectory, he doesn't want to do that to his kids. It's great stuff. So yeah, I don't know how they keep the boys together, and I do see where this could all realign behind Huey with the right, like, you know, bouncing balls falling into the right positions.
Yeah, no, it feels like they're in this sort of empty space where they don't. You know, like you said, they don't have goals that are aligned anymore. They're not against each other, but they're also just doing their own thing. And
yeah,
I know that by, you know, the next couple of episodes or something, things will change and they'll have to join forces again to, you know, fight the greater evil here. But how that's going to happen, I'm not quite seeing it yet. I mean, it's got to be obviously something around Stormfront/Liberty. I think, like, that's kind of the inroad to getting the boys back together. We'll see where it goes, I guess. So Homelander corners Starlight in an elevator, stopped elevator, and physically threatens her because he thinks she's on Hugh's side. She explains that she's not on his side because he betrayed her, and Homelander understands that she's not lying, and lets her go. How convinced are you by this Starlight confession or Starlight defense that she's not on Hugh's side because he betrayed her?
I think that what I believe is that Homelander can absolutely like feel whether you're lying or not because he's got superhuman senses. But I also don't think he's a finely tuned lie detector, and he's pretty easy to sell. Like, you know, she's essentially telling the truth. She isn't furious with Huey. She does feel let down by him. But she also like is a good hero. She's not going to murder someone just because somebody's having a bad day at the office or wants to do some horseshit purity and loyalty test. So like, I don't know. I thought it was it's one of those exhausting things. It's like this could happen every fucking day. And Homelander just like he just instantly like grabs a piece of her internal anatomy. Like I think he reached under her rib cage and is going to start breaking her ribs one by one from the inside. It's like so fucking horrific. And this guy can do this anytime he wants, anytime he gets a suspicion. And is his mental state going to be more and more stable as the season goes on, or probably more and more unstable as Stormfront's pushing him and he loses popularity and Maeve betrays him and he doesn't have anyone to turn to? Like, it's a fucking scary situation. The loaded gun in her face all the time is a really nice metaphor here. So I think that Homelander thinks enough about himself and doesn't understand fundamentally how normal people behave that he is for now convinced that she's telling the truth, because she is. She's telling a one-sided version of it.
Absolutely. And I think in that moment, she kind of believes it. It's only really like in the moments where her and Huey get together and they're face to face and she remembers, you know, what kind of guy he is deep down and forgets the things he's done that have been really shitty, that her opinion of him vacillates between anger at the betrayal and intense, you know, like a puppy love kind of thing. Right. Or trust, some kind of intrinsic trust. I think in this moment, she definitely believes that she's not on his side, but I also don't think she would necessarily kill him if it came to that. She might sacrifice herself to prevent his death.
I think that's a nice realistic take on this kind of inexperienced young relationship that like you do when you fall for someone and they betray. It's not like the first betrayal. Usually you're like, you know what? Fuck this. I'm out. It's back and forth and like, you want them to be the best version of them that you can see. And will they ever get there? That stuff is pretty interesting. I do think that I wonder if, because when, you know, a few scenes from now and they meet in Central Park, it does feel like it was more of an act that she put on for Homelander. And I think narratively they could have gotten away with her being a little bit more standoffish. And then him winning her over by inviting her onto this, you know, this adventure that he's kind of closed her off from. But like, you know, from almost a jump, it's almost like, oh, poor Huey, how are you doing? I missed you and I got your voicemail and all. So like, I kind of almost wish they'd played it to where she was a little bit feeling more of the truth of what she told Homelander. But they didn't go in that direction. So whatever.
Yeah, I in some ways, I'm surprised that she's not a little more pissed about the stuff that her parents did. Like, I mean, Compound V comes out, right, as the thing that causes the superpowers. She thereby knows that her parents did this to her, and yet she still seems to be mostly okay with him. Like, they're telling a story of her becoming more jaded, absolutely. And that's happening pretty rapidly, but also she still feels sort of, you know, naive and childlike, and she's in a limbo there where she could go either way.
Yeah, and I think they did a good job last season showing that her and her mom had already had a falling out about just the extreme Christianity, kind of double standards thing that she lived through. And then early this season, they reestablished that she like didn't take one of her mom's phone calls, so they're still on the out. So it's not as big a betrayal. And even like they show Maeve. Like, it's like there's some people like Black Noir that really takes the and the Deep that really takes the wind out of the sails. But like,
yeah.
I feel like Maeve and maybe Starlight are a little bit further ahead and processing the trauma of being manipulated by adults you trust and love and, you know, being used by them. So she got the headline a season early that everybody else did.
Sure. All right. Black Noir gets one of the techs to pull up info on Butcher, and he pulls up a chair next to her while they search for him. The tech is very intimidated by him, as he probably would be.
But I don't know if they're intimidated as they should be, because like, so does a Vought crime and data analysis, which is what she is. They established that this is like some kind of Vought crime analysis. This is everyone's central bat computer.
Right.
Do you think they know like the shit that Noir and Homelander get up to? Because like, this is like, this is intimidating, like an evidence room supervisor being intimidated by Batman, just, you know, being there requesting stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Or is she intimidated because she knows that this Batman kills people?
I didn't get the impression that the latter was true. I thought it was more just just a generally imposing, intimidating presence.
Because he's like Batman, it doesn't. And like, I just love his like psychotic note. It's like it's written in serial killer letters, like just Butch and the word Butcher. And she's like, would that be William Butcher? And he just stares at her and she's like, oh, okay. No, it's kind of light comic relief. But I wondered, like, yeah, like these are the Vought, if they're the criminal analysts, maybe they actually do know, you know, more about.
I think they would know more than the average person, certainly. You still don't get insights into, like, you know, they're working off traffic cams and shit like that, so they're not going to see like Homelander, you know, lasering a bunch of people and letting a plane go down, right? They're not going to see that, right? But they will see if they're doing stuff in the city. They might have caught some shit on Stormfront, right?
That's like what I was thinking. Yeah
That apartment building, they might know the whole story on that apartment building. Who knows? They've got a real vendetta here, the writers of this episode, against Almond Joy. Like, this is the first instance of it where she's eating an Almond Joy and he comes up and holds up a trash can and forces her to throw it in the garbage.
Yeah, you know, and here's the thing. I unironically love Almond Joy. It's a top five candy bar for me.
Oh, shame on you.
And I Charleston Chew, take it or leave it. But Biddle Honey, good candy.
Fine candy.
So I felt unreasonably attacked.
Yeah, I think you were supposed to. If you're a fan of Almond Joy, you were being attacked this episode.
Yeah, it's such a strange, like, I get it's a non-conventional candy bar, but holy shit, I'm a garbage person? Interesting.
Is the Almond Joy the one that's coconut?
Almond Joy is coconut, but also has the two, like, it's a coconut bar with two almonds on top of it, and then it's all coated in chocolate.
Okay, yeah. It's
so, trash. Yeah, Almond Joy. Mounds is Almond Joy without the almonds.
Okay. They're both trash.
Which is confusing because Mounds, you'd think, would represent the humps of the Almond Joy. It's very confusingly candy.
Oh, you're right.
Candy. Yeah. Like, Mounds is the candy without the mounds.
But then you couldn't
Almond
have
Joy
the Almond
has
Joy
the almonds.
Without the mounds, right? Because those are almonds.
See, I think it would be hilarious if they just did full circle. Then the Mounds was Almond Joy and Almond Joy is Mounds. And the joke is, like, what do you expect Almond Joy to have almonds? Come on.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to Annie meeting Hugh in the park. She laments the things that they've done that have made things way worse. MM calls Huey and says, we're going to Raleigh. Pack your shit. I'll pick you up soon. Hugh can see that Annie is feeling lost and alone, and so he invites her on the mission, which MM is not thrilled, but he does agree to take her along, kind of for Hugh's sake.
Do you think the show is deliberately telling us the story of Annie, Starlight, and Huey being sloppy? Because they're not even taking basic not being recognized precautions. She's chipped. Yeah. They're in Central Park, New York City. I mean, this is like Scarlett Johansson going in like a pullover and a loose ponytail and expecting not to be recognized. She's on literally five-story banners a street over from this place. Like, no one is going to... I just wish that, like, they did that lip service in the very beginning of the season where they're like wearing the sunglasses and the hat and, you know, pulling their coat. They're not even trying. And I'm like, is it the show not being careful, or is it them just... not like them personally being sloppy?
I mean,
in universe,
several of the characters have said you're being extremely sloppy. Like, I mean, that,
there you go. Yeah,
the texting her being the same as phone, like a phone call, is obvious. Uh-huh. And Hugh didn't realize or something, and like,
but it was a burner.
But
that's the thing,
it's
like mother's milk is the guy that usually is saying this, and then they also outed him as being kind of like a worrywart, OCD, germaphobe, you know, some control freak. So it's like the person is telling them that they're being sloppy. The show is also telling me that they're unnecessarily neat and precise and controlling. So I don't know. I just wear a hat and sunglasses. Come on.
They're doing a lot of stuff with like superhero identities and people not recognizing them when they're out of costume. Like, it's the Clark Kent thing, right? You take off the glasses, suddenly you're Superman, you put them on, nobody fucking knows who you are. In this, they're just like taking that a step further, it seems. Like, they're just saying, like, as long as these people aren't actually in their costumes at any given time, no one's going to notice who they are. And I think you're right, they're playing fast and loose, because they did earlier in previous season have her in more of a disguise. But also, they're doing things like, look, the life of a famous person, someone of this level of fame, is not one where they're often given alone time. And if they are given alone time, it's locked up in a hotel room, or it's locked up in their apartment, or the official offices of Vought, where no one can reach them. In this episode, Maeve and Homelander have a conversation in the TV studio. In a fucking television studio, entirely by themselves in a hallway where no one else is. And that just wouldn't happen in real life, right? Yeah. They're playing fast and loose with the idea of, like, what is the level of fame of these people? And when they're in public, like, when they're in their costumes, they're doing their superhero thing, that's when they get recognized. When they're not, they're kind of out of it. And
yeah, You might, like, I'm going to be taking that into future episodes. Like, are they doing a Clark Kent? You know, it's ridiculous, right? Like, the idea that this buff dude can put on glasses and he's not Superman. It's ridiculous to the point of parody. So maybe they are just leaning in on that. And then they subvert so much other stuff, I thought. But then they also, like, she gets a chance to do some derring do, and they're like, I guess she'd be recognized if she's Starlight out of costume doing Starlight stuff, though. I mean, obviously, if she starts finger blasting. Yeah, if she starts finger blasting all the people in the car wreck, if she starts doing her hand blasts or whatever, that would be a problem. Starlight comes and finger blasts you out of your El Camino. That's going to be a red letter day for sure.
So there's a moment here where they're in the park and he gets this call and he says, oh, I got to go. And she asks, what's up? And he's just like, I got to go. Where he's thinking about not telling her, right? Not cluing her in. And he stops himself in that moment and he turns around and he doesn't tell her what's happening, which is the thing he probably should do. Just be honest with her and let her deal with the weight of the situation. But he's catching himself doing that occasionally, and I like that, right? It's a precursor to growth, which he so desperately needs as a character, and this relationship will have to have that kind of growth if it's going anywhere. I like that little moment. You know, it's not on the phone where he can just like say, I'm good, okay, nothing, right. Everything's fine here. He tries to do that and then he catches himself doing it. So we move on to A-Train, seeing the fastest man in the world, not himself, getting onto the Vought elevator, and he goes to Ashley to complain about it, and when he does, Homelander tells A-Train he's out of the seven because he's not fast enough.
Yeah, this guy's, I guess, Shockwave. I don't remember the first season. I think he was going to do a duel. Okay, then he V'd up to beat him. Okay.
Yep.
I like some of this light comedy they put in, like, you know, Vots for Tots, because apparently there's obese babies. He's like, shit, I love fat kids, get me in there.
But
Homelander just dropping the boom on him and saying, like, you're not even, like, let's be honest, you're not even in the top 20 anymore, and it's an embarrassment. Like, he mentioned to Not Madeline before that, like, the seven is just a chain of weak links, and he's starting to rip him out. He's taking Not Madeline's advice to heart. And it's what does A-Train do?
That's a damn good question.
I'm wondering if, like, the boys is going to start swelling to hold some actual superpowered people that are disaffected.
Yeah.
You know, like, you get A-Train, you get like a washed up A-Train, you get a unbrainwashed the deep, you got Kimiko and some of these others that maybe Starlight versus. Yeah. So you got the underground bad guy outfit that's actually the good guys versus the up in the soaring clouds on Tower 99 good guys who are actually the bad guys. I think that would be an almost perfect The Boys type inversion mm-hmm. of your like the comic book expectation.
Yeah, I like it. I also like this scene a lot. There's some unwritten stuff here that I think is going on when A-Train calls bullshit on the whole situation. He's calling bullshit because he's personally offended that he'd be out of the seven. But there's a subtext here with Ashley saying, oh, there'll be a huge outpouring of fan love and support. Like, what she's really saying here is Vought's going to milk your retirement for every single fucking penny that it's worth.
And making it seem like a golden parachute.
Right. And they're just going to exploit the shit out of this. And yeah, as a side effect, you'll get some adoration from fans and maybe make some more cash before you go quietly off into obscurity. But like,
right.
That's the real thing that Vought is doing here. And yeah, I don't think A-Train's calling bullshit on that, but he should be.
Mm-hmm.
So we're on the drive to Raleigh, and Annie's tribute to Translucent is on every radio station except for one, which is playing Billy Joel, and Annie and Huey have a sing-along, which MM pretty much puts a stop to.
Are they old enough to... Because I was a kid when We Didn't Start the Fire came out, man.
Uh-huh.
Like, they're your age, maybe even slightly younger. Did you have firsthand memory of We Didn't Start the Fire?
I will say I don't know every word to We Didn't Start the Fire. And actually, if you get outside of the chorus, like, I can go, I know the rhythm of the verse, but I don't know any of the words to any of the verses.
I always thought it was funny that the thing, like, all the atrocities he rattles off, the thing that breaks him mentally is rock and roll cola wars. I can't take it anymore. Ho Chi Minh, I'm high, yo, fine, I'll take that in stride. You know, Richard Nixon, Palestine, whatever. Fucking rock and roll a cola wars. This new Coke shit. I had it. Burn it all down.
It feels on theme. Remarkably on theme, though, for this show. Like, you've got a...
Right.
You've got a brand new superhero coming in to fuck up the mojo of the seven. And she's doing it with subversion and anger and pissing people off about their pop culture, right? Like...
Oh, yeah.
And it's so fucking true to life. It is so on point. Like, this episode is hitting a lot of sore points for me.
Yeah.
There's some stuff here in quarantine where I'm like, oh, fuck, this is just feeling too real. And this pop culture war that we've got going on that's extending to every side of everything, where you either love or hate the thing and anybody in the middle can get fucked, is like... right on the money. And now that you mention it, that Billy Joel song with the rock and roll cola wars, the thing that breaks him, you know, maybe not in 1981 or whenever the fuck that song came out, but now
they have new Coke Zero, and I'm right, that's it, that's where I flip. Done. That's where I head to the Appalachians and start my career as revolutionary, probably martyr. I was heading to the foothills and I'm never seen again. It's also like, I guess it's one of those kismet things where he's clearly way into Billy Joel, or Billy Joel speaking to him, and it's kind of like, you know, she's kind of into Billy Joel. They're both squares. Yeah, I can. It's cute.
It is, and fuck him in for harshing the vibe here. Like, let him have some fun.
Like, on the other hand, yeah, like, being the third wheel in this situation where you already have been calling bullshit from the beginning, it's like, no, man, it's cool, let her come, she'll be fun, she's a good co-pilot, whatever, and they're just canoodling and you're sitting here, can't listen to music because they're having a conversation, bullshit.
Let them do their thing. Jesus. It's a three-minute song, come on.
Oh, well, see, he knows what to lead into. And I also like the nice touch of them driving past a Homelander with the Confederate flag.
Yeah.
Instead of the star, you know, it's got the stars and bars rather than stars and stripes. It's
a couple of chilling things. Yeah, like that Confederate flag instead of the American flag, which is its normal cape. And then that billboard. Did you see that about you know, what does it say? That baby you abort might be a super, which
right
now after the Compound V reveal takes on a whole nother context, right? Like,
sure.
It's so fucked up to have in a world like, oh, okay, first of all, there's 0% chance, right, that you're now going to have a soup baby unless you fuck a soup.
Because it's a lot. Yeah, it's a lot. And even then, I'm not even sure. I'm not even sure if that guy was super out of the womb, if it like works that way. You know, she got pregnant. Oh, Ryan, and she got pregnant. Yeah. Like the story they told us, she got pregnant. She ran to Vought because she didn't know what to do.
Good point.
Well, you know, so are we certain that this is heritable, or is it more, you know, Compound V fuckery? But yeah,
that's a really good point.
But even before that
reveal, mm-hmm. I think it's more fucked up before the reveal, because here mm-hmm. the implication is there are going to be, you put up a billboard like this, there are going to be a lot of people who are fucking playing the lottery here with kids they mm-hmm. might not want to have. And
oh God, yeah.
There's nothing worse than a parent who doesn't want to have the child, right? Resents the child. Right. Like, they're not going to get a good upbringing. And there would be plenty of people seeing their kids, like plenty of people right now see their kids as the way out of their shitty life, right? Mm-hmm. Now, if they were literally a lottery that they were playing, maybe you'll have a soup baby. That's dark.
Yeah, maybe you will give birth to Superman. And also, there's another context of this billboard is still up after it's been revealed that no one is born a super.
Uh-huh.
So it's kind of like this missing for like the fact that are people who are anti-abortion in this universe more likely to not believe that is there going to be some V truthers that like, this is a whole bunch of bullshit. Nah, supers are born, not made. It's God's will. And it all just kind of rolls in. Like, instead of like each thing being its own belief that can be separable, it's all just rolls into this, you know, worldview and lifestyle that like an attack on one part of it is an attack on all. So like, hell nah, V's not real, because if V's real, then you couldn't abort a super. And I saw the bill.
Which rolls right back into that fuck them if they're not 100% with me mentality.
Exactly. It's cuckoo for cocoa nuts. And it is uncomfortably close to what happens in the real world. And I'm not even going to exempt my side. We have our share of fucking chuckleheads that can't, from first principles, argue morality on our side that scared the shit out of me too. Unfortunately, none of them have any of the levers of power in their hands, or I guess fortunately. So these homelanders with Confederate flags, though, it's a whole other thing.
Sure. Okay, so we go back to a woman being interviewed. She tells the story of the lovers of Valdaro. I didn't quite catch it, and I didn't look it up. This probably is a real thing. Some skeletons who died with their arms around each other. She's saying, you know, she doesn't believe in if you love someone, you should set them free. No, if you love someone, you will never let them go, ever. This is Cassandra. This is the woman mm-hmm. that they pick for him, for the deep to be his wife. This is ominous. You know, like, this should be the warning sign, the red flag. I mean, look, there's 50 million of them. As someone, you know, who's familiar with the way cults operate, he's seen 25 of these red flags already, right? This is a big one, though. Yep. This is the tornado alarm going off saying, get to your fucking shelter, man.
This overly attached girlfriend bull. Yeah, this overly attached girlfriend bullshit's a red flag. The fact that it's wrapped into some kind of cult breeding program. Which I think they're trying to sketch like what's widely rumored to have been the case with Tom Cruise. Have you read some of the conspiracy theories about Tom Cruise's love life, and like that a lot of these are essentially Scientology arranged marriages to help him with his career and to cross pollinate, like, you know, the maximum cultural impact and the blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I've heard so much stuff about Scientology, 90% of which I know is true, mm-hmm. that some of the margins, I'm kind of like, yeah, fuck it. Why not? You know,
it's sure, kind of like say anything about him at this point.
Right. Like there's certain institutions and personalities that get to a point. Bill Simmons used to call it the Mike Tyson zone. Like, a Mike Tyson just showed up with that full face tattoo. It's like, that's the point where it's like, if you heard in the morning, Mike Tyson, you know, broke into the Brooklyn Zoo and killed a gorilla with his bare hands. Like, would you actually take the time to research it? Or would you be like, yeah, that sounds about right? I feel like that's where we're at with this situation. It's like there's almost nothing that I wouldn't believe about him.
Yeah, I'm with you. But definitely this is all about getting your hooks into someone, right, and never letting them go. And that's what cults do. That's what this woman is professing, is the height of relationships is never letting someone go, no matter what.
Yeah, scary.
Yeah. All right, then Butcher climbs the wall to get to Becca's house. Very quick scene. And then Frenchie visits a special lady friend of his. After the sex, they talk about what happened with Kimiko. And she thinks that he's using Kimiko for some kind of absolution of his sins and advises that he just let her grieve. He doesn't want her to grieve alone, though, which I don't know. I can kind of understand, but also she needs to come to you if she needs somebody to grieve with.
Yeah, it's interesting because, like, what does grieving alone do for anybody? Well, it does a lot for some people. And the bottom line is it's that person's business. You can't just, like, blunder in with your preferred method of, you know, getting fucked up and high and converting your grief into sex energy. Mm-hmm. You can't expect that to work for everybody. But this guy, you know, can't. And it's this late. I think her name was Marshmallow. Did I hear that right?
I didn't even catch her name,
because is she some kind of soup? I don't know. She seemed
special, her power being super soft. Like, what?
I she stays puff. You know what she seems like? Do you remember that the band of like hacker adjacent lowlifes that knocked on Neo's door for his own personal Jesus ship? She looks like some random person in that guy's entourage.
Sure.
Has she got superpowers? Is she just a goth? I don't know.
I was thinking maybe like she this person auditioned for both Marina Baccarin's role in Firefly and also for the girl with the dragon tattoo and like lost out on both of them. But that's just, you know, her lifestyle.
And now she's Marshmallow. But yeah, no, there is like there's some kind something in her affect where she's like really. It's heavy going trying to get this guy, lead this guy along to some kind of emotional breakthrough. Like she's kind of like borderline exasperated with how like literal he's being and, you know, I don't know what to think about Frenchie. I did want to go back. I did not realize that Becca is essentially living on a Vought compound. Mm-hmm. Like a walled city, something like that. I didn't get that. I thought she lived in some kind of just like tucked away neighborhood, but apparently her and Ryan just live in total isolation. Like there's a, she's allowed out because he can go to see a piano teacher and all this other stuff. But like, it does seem like a very lonely existence, which if I had caught on to that before, I would have maybe given a little bit more weight to what Homelander was trying to do with Ryan, where he's trying to like, you know, we're just have a lonely lifestyle, kid. You know, it's like no one can relate to us.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's because of the circumstance, not because of the intrinsic truth of what he's saying.
Yeah. There's some super interesting stuff, I think, to talk about when it comes to that. And we'll get there in some upcoming scenes. But for now, we go back over to a roadside diner where MM and Starlight share dessert-based stories about their fathers. And on their way out, a car accident happens right in front of them. And Annie wants to help the people involved, but MM and Hugh convince her that it would draw too much attention. So they just take off.
Yeah, and I don't know. It's like it's pretty funny stories. I kept on like thinking as Mother's Milk was telling stories about his father, like, because at some point, like Huey and Starlight were giving him significant looks that I think is just them being impressed at him sharing. But I was getting the idea of like, is he telling tall tales? Like, are some of these stories not literally true about his dad? But I don't, after the second time, I'm off of that theory, but I want to see if you thought that like, we think we're getting a lot about Mother, but is he telling the actual unvarnished truth, or is he telling something that is designed to get Starlight to do the thing he wants Starlight to do? Is it designed to get the lady whose brother was killed by Liberty to trust him? But I don't think that's the case.
No, I think it's a fair question to ask. I wasn't getting that impression, and I hope that's not the case, because I do want some character development from MM other than just like, want to get back to my family.
Yeah, at some point they kind of stop subverting things and tell a fucking story.
Yeah, yeah.
The characters will just be parodies of themselves.
Yeah. So yeah, we'll see if that's actually true, or we won't. So Butcher gets Becca's attention and they drive out to a secluded spot for a tearful reunion. Becca reveals that she convinced Homelander not to hurt him by threatening to kill herself and tell her son that it was Homelander's fault if he did that. Mm-hmm. Butcher wants to help her escape, so they plan for her to sneak out in a garbage truck sometime soon. Kind of nebulous. And she has to get back, but tells him to wait there for her.
Yeah, I thought this was weird, too, the pacing of all this. The fact that, like, she's going to leave him here, but she'll be right back. And I don't know. I thought it...
Really? As someone who's had clandestine relationships before, as a teen, this feels so much like that. Like, I'm going to sneak out wrong. For a cigarette. But, you know, it's not a cigarette when you're a teen, right? It's like, oh, right. I'm going to meet my friend at the mall.
Sure.
Whatever. I'm going to do whatever you got to say to make it work. And then, like, I can see you for 3 minutes here. And then, like, you know, stay here for 2 hours and I'll be back and we can see each other for another 12 minutes. Like, that kind of thing felt right.
It just doesn't work for me because I just feel like Becca, like, she's wired for sound and camera. Like, the idea that they wouldn't have a tracker on her vehicle, or there's not a hidden mic in her vehicle, or it just felt like she's on his maximum security with, like, one of the most expensive clandestine assets in Vought's inventory, and they're just going to let her fuck around and act suspicious. Like, how many totally middle fair. Of night yeah. smokes does she do back to back ever? And like, there's nobody watching to be like, hey, you know, there might be some kind of weird shit going on here. I don't know that, but that's maybe not fair to the show. Because I mean, it's going to be increasingly hard in the coming years to tell a story of someone like breaking out of jail or evading cops in a city with facial recognition that drones can use from a mile away. Like, you know, like the way that cell phones have destroyed some very common plot contrivances. Mm-hmm. This shit, it's like anyone having a clandestine meeting away from Big Brother is going to seem ridiculous in like 5 years time, it feels like.
Oh, but yeah, I feel
it's
like
not
if
fair
you're writing
to the show to do that.
If you're writing future fiction right now, you have to be thinking of ways to tell stories where no one has any privacy whatsoever and can be found at a moment's notice, mm-hmm. wherever they are, by almost
it's one of the more ridiculous things us going through and rewatching Star Trek on our blocks is like the sheer amount of times of people just to get away with hiding on the ship.
Right. Like,
come on, you know. It's like that would never happen.
Or the lack of AI, you know, like the lack of automation, the lack of like so many things that we see are trends now that are going to continue and accelerate. You got to be thinking about that writing future fiction now.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, you're right. It is kind of insane that they wouldn't be able to suss this out. But I'm part of me is happy for Butcher. Part of me is like, why should I give a fuck? This guy hurts everyone around him. And I'm kind of glad that eats its own tail by the end of this thing, right? Like,
yeah.
They have that reunion, but also it's bittersweet because she knows that the reunion is temporary and, you know, he was fucked up before they met and nothing has changed about that. And now she's got,
and it's
got
to be
bigger stakes.
It's got to be such a blow to Butcher that she prefers status quo with the Homelander to the certainty she thinks that if she goes off with her on the road with him, that he'll murder her son at some point, you know, like, wow.
Yeah. I didn't even think about it from that angle. It's wow. Fucked up. Okay. MM and Hugh share a room for the night. When MM falls asleep, Huey sneaks out to meet Annie at the vending machine. They talk about candy bars, MM's OCD and their own stress symptoms for a while. And they end up back in her room where they bone down. Another hateful Alma Joy scene. Charleston Chews get a little bit of become a punching bag and so do a bit of honey.
I mean, I'll cop the bit of honey being old people candy. Like, I like it because it was part of something my grandparents used to have around. I still like it.
I like Werther's original. Joy. Like, quintessential old person candy. I don't give a shit. It tastes good.
Yeah, on the way to picking up my son for the night, I'm going to stop by a gas station, get us both Almond Joys. How you like that, boys?
Mm-hmm.
You've done the opposite of shame me. I'm even more emboldened in my disgusting candy tastes.
what's the cowtails? Is that?
I mean, here's the thing. You got circus peanut. Why, as long as people are buying and consuming circus peanuts, why are we wasting time shaming anyone with a coconut milk chocolate almond fetish?
Or like Peeps.
Yes.
Throw those in the fucking river.
They speaking of Compound V, did you see these sriracha peeps this spring?
No.
Who wanted Tabasco infused peeps? Yeah, man.
A stunt candy at this point, right? Like
you get peeps and you get circus peanuts off the market. I'll entertain what we should do about Charleston shoes. But this is like, you know, worrying about Tide Pods while people are drinking Drano. Like, come on.
Peeps' business model at this point is to get people to post pictures of their bullshit flavors on Instagram and throw the garbage candy in the trash. They still have to buy them to take the picture. So
I think Peeps is still the only candy that can actually expire. And it's the only candy that expires within a week. Like, you maybe can make an argument that, like, well, hey, it's a sugar encrusted marshmallow. How bad can it be? That argument goes out the windows 5 days into that Peeps lifestyle because they turn into bricks. They turn into sand. They turn into oddly shaped sanding blocks within a week.
So do circus peanuts, man. Like, those Jesus, two candies,
yeah.
Fuck
they're
both.
Just packing material that we've been tricked into eating.
Yeah. You're not wrong. I didn't know Starlight could control lights with her powers. Have they shown that she controls electricity stuff?
They might have done something in a Dog and Pony with her last where she can do that. Like, she can turn light on and off. But I don't know. I was actually, when her eyes started glowing in, like, conjunction with bedtime, I'm like, well, this is going to be interesting. Some super-powered sex. Like, holy fuck. You got to go back to, like, Steve Gutenberg in Cocoon since the last time I saw one of these jobs. but no, she's a turn on. Well, it's weird. She turns off the lights and says, I still want to see you. Well, then why'd you turn the lights? I thought they were off. No. I thought they were shooting, like, you know, the Hollywood, like, you're supposed to understand that this is a pitch black room.
Yeah.
So.
No, I think she just turned them down. So. All right. Another woman is being interviewed, and she thinks the love is about faith. She tells the story of getting an Ed Sheeran tattoo for her boyfriend, who 2 weeks later broke up with her. And so now, well, I think she always hated Ed Sheeran, but now she hates him even more.
Now she's not in love with the shape of him that's
permanently
tattooed on his arm.
And, you know, remarkably for an organization that purports to be a church, they do not care about having a wife who thinks that faith is the foundational building block of a relationship. You should be taking note of that as well. The deep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Red flags.
Yep.
Ed Sheeran, red flag.
So then Becca returns to the bridge with her and Butcher, where her and Butcher strip down and get it on in her car. Afterward, Butcher asks how she's holding up, and she tells him all about Ryan. She says that she heard he was on a warpath against Homelander, and he promises that he'll make all of this up to her until the day he dies. This is where stuff gets interesting, because I think, like, what he's hearing here is her asking about how he's doing. And when he asks how she's doing, it's not asking how she's holding up personally in this. It's how, like under Homelander in captivity, like, this is about, to her, this is about raising Ryan and being a mother, right? Like, that's the defining thing about her life now, not being a captive under Homelander, which is the defining thing to Butcher. They're kind of talking past each other.
This was a really rewarding thing to do on rewatch, is that, like, because honestly, my reaction when she accuses him of, like, being anti-Ryan is like, I don't know if this is fair, but, like, it's all on his face when she tries to, like, she at one point in the conversation turns it into trying to sell him on Ryan. Oh, he's such a good kid, and he's happy, and he's kind, and he's thoughtful, and he's just kind of like, yeah, sure, babe, And you can see that he's just not connecting and not liking. And I completely didn't get that the first time through. So it's a really, really good performance, too, by Carl Urban, of this guy who's like, this is what he wants. he just, oh man, if there's anything, I do about this kid, I got to get my wife out from under this. He sees that as part of the Homelander situation, right?
Yeah.
Do you think they're going to do anything weird? Like it turns out that this kid actually is Butcher's kid that they've pumped full of Compound V.
I don't know, because I find myself in this scene asking the question, where does Butcher go from here? Because he doesn't have Becca that he needs to, you know, help make up for the mistakes that he's made before. He doesn't have the goal of, I think, taking revenge on Homelander anymore for killing her. So, like, what do they do with him? And Homelander can't really kill him yet, because there's still this threat of Becca killing herself if, you know, Homelander does that. Now that could change if Homelander is able to win the loyalty of Ryan over the course of the next X amount of time,
or gets bored and feels like that's not worth it anymore, and he's no longer afraid of what the kid thinks.
But I don't know what they're going to do with Butcher. I guess he might just disappear again, like we talked about, and then come
or he
back
might
when
go to
needed.
A team that has a little bit more supers on it, and he learns that, like, you know, not all supers are created equal. There are people like Starlight that, like, are just like any other human.
Yeah,
has their good qualities and their bad qualities, and like they there's a natural arc that him and Becca could go back to being compatible, but he's got to do some personal growth about his personal vendetta and his feelings about, because the other thing is, like, it's put aside the Ryan shit, this guy who's single-mindedly going after Homelander is a guy, he's courting death.
Oh yeah,
that's no life for a person trying to raise a kid. Fuck that. So even if he didn't have a personal hard on against Ryan, just his foolhardy way of life to try to punish Homelander, she just, like, you know, like, she, I think she says something like, this thing that you've got started before me and I can't fix it. Like, he has to resolve that. And I don't know whether that's going to look like him killing Homelander, what seems crazy, or him getting over it.
Mm. All right. There's a real quick scene the next day when Annie and Huey are making eyes at each other in the car. MM's not too thrilled with it. And then we go back to Homelander and Maeve going on the in-depth talk show with Maria Menounos.
Can't wait to see this when I finally go back to a theater.
Right.
In a year from now.
They ask about the diversity within Vought, and that prompts Homelander to out Maeve as a lesbian, revealing that he knows everything about Elena. And when Maeve gets defensive, he wishes her and Elena luck, but neither Maeve nor us as an audience is buying this from Homelander.
Hmm.
I don't think another... I wasn't. What was your feeling on that?
No, I don't. I mean, well, here's the thing. Like, maybe he's being sincere, but sincere in a way that Homelander could change his mind on a whim. It's not like any kind of lasting thing, because he doesn't have any kind of, like, bedrock moral principles. It's whatever is best for him or his own self-image, and maybe he wants to be the bigger man and decide that, like, he's over all this and he still needs an ally on the Seven. But that is not because he's a good dude, it's just because that's the way the personal calculus has worked out in his mind.
Yeah,
but I know it's another thing that they've reworked, to like the Oscars so white, you know, that's, and I thought this was fascinating, because, like, in this universe, what kind of hay did white supremacists make over the fact that the disproportionately superpowered people came from white households?
And that the most,
like,
powerful.
there had to be a lot of New York Times opinion pieces and think pieces just asking questions, you know?
Right.
Just
right.
These blessings are all genetically dealed out. Why is it that some race gets a hell of a lot more? And why are, you know, Latino and Asians, like, less than 1%?
And now that's all shattered, right? Now that it's an orchestrated thing, right?
Right, right. So now it's like as life turns out to be, it's not, life isn't racist. It's the systems built around them,
right?
It's going to be interesting. And then, you know, you could all follow that up as like, what's that say about a corporation currently held by a man who's a minority himself? You know, it's kind of like, oh, what, if a black cop shoots a black person, is that racist? Well, yeah, if the cop's working for a racist system, like, there's all kinds of things that don't that don't quite jive with like a common sense understanding of it. But
sure.
It's interesting. It's an interesting lens to look through like our current culture. You know, you just make it, you just heighten some absurd thing about it. And then I don't know. I almost think it's like in another, like 5 years ago, would this allowed, or 10 years ago, this allowed culture to take a step back and evaluate some of these things in kind of a safe way? Or is it now?
That's the thing, man. You say like, oh, heighten this aspect of our real culture. I think The Boys goes for shock value. The Boys goes over the top and they try and heighten everything. I think they're going to have a damn hard time heightening any kind of racism in this show. I think our culture at this point has gotten to a place where parodying, lampooning, like over exaggerating the problems of racism in our society is going to be tough.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're going to need Stormfront to go a hell of a lot farther than she's gone already, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to what they try and do with that.
I mean, because at least she was at least chasing an actual dangerous person down. Like, what if she was just in the wrong building across town and killed all those people in a racist manner for, you know, not even a pretext?
I mean, like, it's Breonna. They could have done that. And it would have been like,
right. That's what I'm saying. They like, that's not as absurd as some of the things that's happened this year.
Right. Right. I don't know what they can do to say, hey, we're being absurd. You know?
Yeah, it's a good point. And the absurdity also, like, I do wonder, there's going to be a lot of people, I think, watching this show, for very, you know, just the same way that there's a lot of white supremacists to watch American History X and they just unironically idolatrize Ed Norton's performance.
Yeah.
Like there's going, like, I wouldn't surprise me if you don't start seeing, you know, racist groups with Homelander merchandise and stuff, Stormfront merchandise, logos and things. Like, why not?
Absolutely.
You know, like the fucked up branches of the police have adopted the Punisher, even though the Punisher is explicitly like, the Punisher would kill you dudes. The Punisher would be the first one to hunt down every cop that's got a Punisher skull tattoo on his gun arm. Like, that's who he is, man. Like, yes. You just co-opt the parody and make it into your self-image and keep rolling.
Sure. All right. Homelander sees Stormfront on the news riling up her protest crowd. And Kimiko shows up at that protest ready to kill her. But Frenchie distracts her long enough that she misses her shot. I don't think Kimiko could take on Stormfront in any way. I think Frenchie is right here. He saved her life in that moment. But yeah, she's pissed and she's going to make some mistakes, I'm sure.
And it's another thing where he is trying to countermand the thing that she wants to do. Again, probably for the right reasons, but this is not going to endear him to Kimiko, I do not think.
No.
He's got a lot, and he's got a lot of growing up to do before he can even get to the place where that's going to happen. So is this going to be the slowest of all burn relationships? I almost feel like one of these two has to die at the end of the season, because this show, I can't imagine, has the patience to turn this into something that would be worth getting invested in. Right.
And will they do that with every character? Right. It's like, oh, are they going to redeem?
You're right.
You know, Butcher, are they going to get Annie and Huey together? And then are they also going to do it with Frenchie? They're going to pair off MM with, you know, his family. Who knows?
Because it's a perfectly valid story to tell that, like, you know, good, fundamentally good people sometimes do bad things and they pay a cost for it that keeps them from doing being happy. You know, like Butcher might not have a game plan to be happy going forward, but maybe, you know, like maybe one or two, like Mother's Milk. He's the one person I'm invested in. Like, I want to see this man reunited with his wife and kids.
Yeah.
Like, he seems like the most pure, good guy of the Boys. And I'm really hoping, but you're probably right. Like, trying to get a happy ending for everybody in the Boys is not.
Yeah. We haven't seen the Boys in the really cards. Pay too many costs yet.
Other people have paid the prices. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But they've got to start paying prices, and that's going to mean, you know, severe consequences. All right. MM makes it to the address that he got from Butcher, and Smooth talks his way into the good graces of the woman in the house with a story about his father campaigning against Vought until the day he died. She talks about a payoff that she took when her brother was killed by Liberty. who she claims is actually unaged and living as Stormfront. Dun, dun, dun.
And did you think the Liberty sounded like Stormfront in the flashback?
Slightly. Like, on second watch, I definitely was looking for that. And, yeah, ish.
I was kind of looking for it, and I thought, nah, ish. But, okay. You know, it's might be one of those Laurel Yanni things where...
Right.
Yeah, it's definitely her in a voice box, but she's giving like a slightly different performance or a more old timey performance. I don't know.
She's wearing a black dress, right? It's black and gold. White and
I didn't get a good look at it. I don't know what she looks like. I can just think of the cartoon image of her. Holy shit.
So on the drive home, they try to make sense of what they've just learned, and Huey tells MM that his father was a hero, but MM thinks it was just his OCD and his maniacal rage against the Vought machine.
Yeah, the got him killed, might get him killed, might get his kids killed. Yeah, I wonder, what is MM's backstory? How did Vought screw him over? How did his father fight back? Those are going to be, I imagine we'll get the answer to all that.
Yeah. I do wonder, they're trying to, you know, make sense of all that. Have they considered the possibility that this is like Stormfront's daughter Liberty's daughter is Stormfront? The idea of a superhero that doesn't age is pretty powerful. Like, if your superpower could just be patience, that might be an interesting thing.
You know, you mentioned that that could be their daughter. Rang a bell because several characters have mentioned that Ryan is the spitting image of Homelander, which I don't buy. Yeah. I don't think he particularly looks like Anthony Starr, but
he's
like
got blonde hair. Universe are telling.
Yeah, in universe are telling is he's the spitting image of Homelander. So I wonder if you're supposed to like use that clue on this mystery and think like instead of like, oh, there's an immortal super out there, it's like, yeah, it's just a daughter.
And it's crazy to me because like, you know, very similarly to how I didn't see the shapeshifter coming, and I absolutely should have. I have never, even though Homelander and Ryan exist as father and son soups, I have been assuming that Ryan is somehow the first soup baby, which is almost impossible, right? If soups have been around since World War One, or World War II at the very latest, like,
oh, born
there's
soup
no
baby?
Way yeah. that this is the first soup baby. How has this not become a thing?
And you just be clear, you're not saying soup, because literally we saw soup babies last season. You're saying genetically someone came out of the womb, yeah. Sans V, super.
Born okay. as a soup because they had you know, sex with a superhero.
Yeah, like, just genetic, super genetics, yeah.
Yeah. Ryan can't be the first. There's no way. But I don't know. I felt like the show was trying to tell me that.
Also, I really dug Mother's Milk's vintage Black Panther t-shirt in these scenes. Very, very cool.
Did he have one? Oh, I didn't notice.
Yeah, it's People's Public Food Program. That's how the Black Panthers got started, trying to feed kids school lunches to underprivileged school districts.
It's the more you know.
Then they started carrying guns, and then Ronald Reagan, Governor of California, banned open carry because you can't let that happen.
Yeah, powerful black people with weapons, sure.
Yeah.
All right, Homelander scrolls through the seven memes online, and he's pissed. And he goes to Stormfront and claims that he's still the best soup, and no one's going to take what he built. And she tries to teach him a lesson on how to connect with his audience, mostly through the radicalization of his fans, but he's not interested in her advice.
Did you think, I think they could have done a little bit better with the Homelander browsing memes. Some of them were okay, but some of those memes were some weak ass shit that like the writer's room, I think that would have been the fun part of the week of that. Like, hey, let's come up with a bunch of anti-Homelander and pro-Stormfront memes in today's meme lexicon.
Oh yeah.
But they were mostly kind of weak sauce, which... To be fair, a lot of memes are dumb shit anyway, and if you're just pounding them like Homelander is, you're going to get some duds, but I don't know. I was like wanting to, I started freeze framed like, oh, this is going to be a real treat, like all these, and no, they're not really. They're just literally someone said, download a couple memes off of Reddit, the front page of Reddit, and then just literally rework them into Homelander shit.
Yeah,
it's a bummer.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Was there literally like the guy with his girlfriend looking back?
Yes, at Stormfront? Yes, and that's okay. One of the better ones, and that's like yeah. That's the most obvious one, you know?
Right.
Like they didn't, but you know they could have had Kermit drinking tea. Stormfront's a better people's hero than Homelander, but that's none of my business. Like, come on. They're easy.
Stormfront's better than Homelander. Change my mind. Like
that kind of yeah, thing. Exactly. Yeah, get Steven Crowder's ass out there. Exactly.
Sure. So
the other thing is like she's also got this psychosexual thing because she taunts him until his eyes start shining, and then she backs down and says she could offer help, and then says, you know, when he goes, I don't need your help, he's like, well, my door's open, and she's like, for anything, wink wink. Come over to my okay. port sailor if you got a storm. I do you think that I don't know, are they gonna kill each other or fuck?
Frankly, I'm asking myself why he hasn't killed her already. I don't know honestly what he needs with any of the seven at this point.
How would they explain that?
That's the thing, other than like, oh, it would hurt his public image, why right. doesn't he just murder a bunch of soups?
Yeah, if she ever gets assigned to go to the Homelander to take down a super terrorist or a super villain, I would be on high alert if I were her, because yeah. the idea you're just gonna go missing in action is pretty high. Mm-hmm. And a tribute for you being sung by Starlight and pretext for ever broadening war. Yeah, no, I can totally see that.
So Becca comes back to the bridge where Butcher is and tells him that she's not leaving this compound because she doesn't believe the Butcher wants to be a father to her son. He lets slip his true feelings about her super freak son. And she says he's too angry and too fragile to trust, essentially. And leaves after warning him that she has called in the guards.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this a lot already, but like, holy shit, you know, it's so surface level that just her essentially asking like a question, like, you're going to try to off this kid within, you know, maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon and for the rest of his life. And he's like, oh, well, why do you even care about that soup powered shit, Voight baby? Fuck, fuck, fuck. Yeah, he just can't help himself. Like, It's yeah. not buried at all. It was right there at the surface, and she's completely right. And it's unfortunate. And then she even makes it clear that it's not even about, like, even if we get past a Ryan thing, you are just fucked in the head. Like, you yeah. know, you're going to, if Homelander's dead and Ryan's fine, you're going to get a gun pulled at you in some Walmart parking lot on Black Friday because you're just crazy. You've got an overdeveloped sense of justice and retribution. And I think she's got him dead to rights.
Absolutely. Black Noir and the tech find Butcher going over the fence. Very quick scene there.
Mm-mm. And
then Annie and Huey say goodbye after their road trip. Annie says they can't get together again because they can't afford to feel good or safe in this world where they're all alone. She's getting super jaded. Huey's disappointed, obviously.
Because I mentioned that these relationships mirror each other. This is a way for Huey and Butcher to connect. Their women essentially rejected them because of their involvement in this outfit. And that shared sacrifice might be, I could see a drinking episode where they get some, work through some shit. Maybe
they'd have to be mind bendingly drunk, just blackout. Like, for Butcher to ever reveal anything of himself to Huey, like, because Butcher views Huey as this beta cuck, like, fucking...
Right.
He's a child in Butcher's mind. There's no way he's going to open up to him unless he's blind drunk. Then maybe. Yeah. And then you can start to build a relationship from there.
Yeah, it's something they both have in common.
You're not wrong. Yeah, absolutely. Another shot fired at Almond Joy with this John Wayne Gacy comment. Used to hand those out to kids.
Yeah, now I'm a fucking mass murderer psycho. God, yep. That's like, I like coconut and almonds, all right?
Yeah, and then this, we're all alone. That's the truth. It doesn't have to be like that. This episode is really hitting home in this moment of isolation here in this pandemic. It's like, Jesus Christ, we're so divided. We're so physically and ideologically divided. Come on, people. Mm. Then there's the final interview with another woman who says she's very sexual feminist. It's revealed that these interviews are for the purpose of picking the Deep's new church wife, and he chooses the sexual feminist. Unfortunately, Carol insists it has to be the one with the skeleton story, Cassandra, because it serves his goal of getting back into the Seven.
I loved how this reveal of what it is and like the Deep's reactions, like, well, Case, let's cancel all the other interviews. Like, we found the one right here, right here. Look at this woman. She's made of compound V and sex, apparently.
Yep.
Yeah. She's like, no, it's Cassandra. Are you talking about Cassandra with the hair and the skeletons? It's fun. And like, I thought I got to choose. Oh, you do. It's just, you're making this choice and it's culty as fuck.
Oh, God. Yeah.
How is this going to get them back into the Seven? I mean, this, like I said, this is very broadly a pastiche of Scientology bullshit.
Yeah.
And it feels like, because I can't imagine that, that's just such a you know, heart goes out to people affected by Scientology, but it's not nearly as high stakes as some of the other stuff they're doing when it comes to, like, government, you know, fuckery and invasions of privacy and systemic racism and with the how personal bias and prejudice reinforce those things. Like, then you got like this sketch with Scientology and Patton Oswalt singing Gills. Like, I feel like it's permanently, the Deep is just comic relief.
So far.
Yeah. I don't even know how they spin this. And because like he's not going to make the Seven again. Although I guess I could see a lot of the more Seven people dying. A-Train's already out, right?
And I think it's kind of key that Homelander has some kind of psychological
the Deep is leverage loyal to over him. The Deep,
right?
Yes.
He's able to constantly hammer him into whatever shape he wants him in, and I think that's important to Homelander.
Yeah,
he owns him.
Yeah, so I think you're right. Maybe.
Speaking of Homelander, he goes to see Madeline again, but he is not in the mood for any of her old tricks, and he claims he doesn't need anyone but himself. So, Doppelganger turns into Homelander and offers to suck himself off. Homelander calls him pathetic, kills him, now claiming he doesn't need anyone at all.
You know, this thing had me going the whole time, because like every single thing that happened, I'm like, I might see Anthony Starr suck Anthony Starr's dick. I might.
Hey, man.
I might. It's Why within not? This house. It's within the performance envelope of this show. It's wild. Yeah, it's some wild shit.
The moment he turns into Homelander and he's still in that negligee and he's saying, you like what you see?
With the gold earrings.
It's hilarious.
It's really funny. And I wonder, Anthony Starr is hard. He's got this way of performing like at three different levels. And I honestly didn't know how close he was to being tempted, because is a raging narcissist, which literally is named after this Greek mythology figure that fell in love with their own reflection to the point that they wasted away and died or became planted as a tree or something because they couldn't tear them away. So like it's super on brand for him to want to, I don't know.
And I can see the battle going on in his head because he's also a homophobe. So like,
and
how
and
gay
Madeline's
do you think
like
this
not,
is, and he has to reassure himself that it's not
gay. It's masturbation. It's like, it's some wild. And I'm like, also I felt really bad for the doppelganger because he's just doing whatever he thinks might keep him from getting his neck snapped. Like there's nothing.
Yeah.
He's like this all this fucked up shit that like surely he's not into this. He's just doing it because he wants to gratify Homelander. It's got to be terrifying.
For sure. Yeah, he's a captive. But that's it. That's it for the episode. I thought it was a good one, you know, despite not having the big overarching kind of.
So next stuff. Week, if Madeline shows up again, it's got to be a robot or a genetic manipulation or something.
Oh, another shapeshifter replaced by. I don't know. Shifty, the superhero who shifts shape.
Gangledopper is going to come in. It turns out. Because he keeps making the same fundamental mistake, though, right? Like he doesn't say he needs anyone, but he's just gaping black hole of need. And he keeps killing the things that give him this, these surrogates, it's, sources of love. Mm-hmm. And, I don't know, he'll probably move on just beating the holy hell out of Stormfront or fucking her or something.
Yeah. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah. I can't wait for next week's episode. Okay. We do have a spot of feedback from the last week. It's going to be, since we're recording all these in advance, it's going to be interesting because traditionally something comes out on Sunday, for example, and then we record a podcast on Tuesday afternoon. That gives, you know, close to 2 days for people to give feedback on the present episode to us. Mm. But since we're releasing these literally the second that they drop, all of the feedback you're going to hear for this episode at the end of the fourth episode is going to be essentially for episodes 1 through 3, etc. We're all going to be like 1 week in arrears on this stuff. But anyway, up front is Kenny from Spokane says they're super excited for us to be covering The Boys. Thank you. We're pretty excited ourselves. I was just thinking it'd be interesting to see Giancarlo Esposito's character use the threat to destroy Homelander's public image as a way to control him. Seems like they must have plenty of dirt on him, and all it would take is a leaked video to destroy him publicly. There could be some good social commentary on cancel culture. What do you guys think?
I guess it depends on how much he cares about that. So far, we've seen that he does care about it, but what are his limits there, I guess?
Yeah, because he cares about Madeline up until he burns her eye sockets out. Like, there's a thin line between love and hate, and yeah. That line, when it's applied to Homelander, is scary.
Uh-huh.
So, I do think that, yeah, you got to have a plan to manipulate this guy and to deal with him in a way that doesn't rely on just pretty please and soft power. Like, you got to have some power. And I'm curious to see how that will reflect. Or maybe not. Maybe it wouldn't be the first time a corporation has, you know, rode to power a bull that ended up goring them to death in some spectacular way.
Mm-hmm.
Kenny's side question is, who would you guys cast portray the Boys equivalent to video games beloved Booger Man? Do you remember Booger Man?
Vaguely.
It's a pretty obscure, I think, Sega Genesis era video game character that I, here's my dirty little secret. All of the 16-bit video game systems, I ditched 8-bit and went to PC. So, like, there's a huge gap in my console history from, like, the Nintendo Entertainment System to, like, PlayStation 3. I got out of all that stuff in favor of PC. So, I don't know Booger Man.
Yeah, I was an NES guy. My cousins had the Genesis. But I feel like the name is evocative enough that you just cast Paul Giamatti and you're done with it.
That's a pretty good Booger Man. I was going to suggest Badger from Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
He seems like he could be a booger. Yeah. Thanks for listening. Robert W. says, you have to imagine that Stan, Edgar, and Vought have had some kind of backup plan for a rogue super other than just try to talk him out of killing us all. Right? Right? You got to have...
Yeah,
you gotta have a stick to go with the carrot.
I mean, Compound V is a synthetic drug that they've created. You create the Superman, you're gonna want to have the kryptonite also created, right? Like, at least, you know, a cautious company would. And I don't know. We're talking about like a bunch of leftover Nazi scientists and a lunatic. So I don't know what precautions they have in place. But you know, you create the compound, you create the anti-compound alongside it. Yeah. I would hope.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing with the Nazis. Half of them had syphilis, half of them were addicted to methamphetamines, and then there's a,
wow.
There's a probably a lot of overlap there, too,
uh-huh.
of meth-addicted, syphilitic, brain-being-eaten kind of types. Robert continues, I'm hoping to see some kind of Compound V neutralizing agent.
Yeah.
Or some kind of clone trooper-esque brain implant that would at least somewhat even the level playing field against Homelander, or else... even if everything the Boys want to happen comes to fruition, Homelander can just kill the president and declare himself king of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that would be interesting. Some kind of like Order 66 mental conditioning that they did as babies that they can, you know,
like a Manchurian anti-candidate, like kill yourself kind of thing. I don't even know if Homelander could kill himself.
Cannot self-terminate. No, I like a Compound V neutralizing agent. That would be very cool. Something that rapidly breaks down the compound in their body and renders them mortal. A condition, or like what if you had some kind of literal explosive device, like what explosive device could sever Homelander's C3-4 vertebra, right?
I don't
know. The right shape charge internally, like that fucked up translucent man's diamond skin, you know, getting something on the inside of him.
Yeah, maybe he's got the same weakness.
Yeah, but yeah, something. I gotta imagine that the more powerful the super, the bigger the stick that Stan holds over their head. He then wants to pivot to, what's Vought's explanation for owning all of the country's superheroes? If their cover story is they're born naturally, how did Vought come to find and control all of them?
I don't know that that's true. They control the Seven, who are by far the most popular. I think, you know, guys like Mesmer and Gecko are out there just doing their own thing.
That's kind of like asking, like, how does the NFL own all the country's student athletes? They don't really. It's just they have the team that they all want to aspire. So they have a huge amount of power in who they platform, who they push down, whose career, who they force into retirement, who they're ready to take the next step. Like, I don't think they control everyone, every regional city superhero. It's just they have all those are essential farm teams for them, in exactly the same way that, like, there's not a literal relationship. Like, the, you know, Nebraska University is not a farm team for the NFL, but they also kind of are. Mm-hmm. Especially Nebraska. You know, farm teams, come on.
Oh boy.
El Skid says, I have thoughts and questions about Homelander, Becca, Butcher, and Homelander and Becca's son Ryan. First and foremost, I think Becca and Ryan live inside a Truman style fake town. I don't think she is driving into Vought's installation like I had speculated in episode 3. I think she's trying to drive out. When she drives up to the checkpoint, the wall curves in towards where she came from, not out around some complex. It also makes sense to me when Homelander asks, what are you going to do, when he wants to go out to the beach or to the baseball game? Yeah, I did not catch all that. And it's made explicit in this episode, season 2, episode 4. So good eye for that, Elskid. Secondly, what's the nature of the relationship between Becca and Homelander? She's never claimed that Homelander assaulted her. She does say at one point, after what you've done, but it's vague and I believe intentionally so. We only have Billy Butcher's claim of rape. In season 1, where we see the security footage of her entering Homelander's office, I came away thinking she had a fling with Homelander and made sense to me that Billy could only make sense of it by convincing himself that she was assaulted. Don't misunderstand. If she makes the claim it wasn't consensual, that's 100% truth for me. But I think the show is messing with us by keeping some things vague and establishing facts with a single biased witness. Interested to hear your take on things.
Made explicit this episode.
Yeah, and the other thing is, like, I think the show's being cagey, but I talked about this a little bit on our live watch on twitch.tv/baldmove. But I think what they're actually, it wouldn't surprise me at all if what they're going for is that Homelander's son's not Homelander's son, it's actually Butcher's son. There's some trickery there involving Compound V and Switch Around and not, like, literal genetics. I just saw the same kind of, like, they're being intentionally vague about some aspects. But the other thing is, like, if you define a coercive relationship as, like, a massive power imbalance and the one party not being able to say, you know, say no, like, for example, without knowing much about Thomas Jefferson's relationships with his slaves that he fathered children with, most people are comfortable to say that that's a rape. Like, even if one of those slaves happened to have feelings for him, like, there's no way she could say no to that relationship, right? Same way, like, when a boss has sex with an underling, it's automatically a coercive relationship. And it makes you ask the question, can Homelander have a consensual relationship with any mortal? You know?
Sure.
Like a truly consensual, non-power imbalance, non-exploitative, non-coercive relationship, especially knowing that he's psychopathic and likes to get his way or kill people. Uh-huh. Like, it's kind of like, it reminds me of who's the guy on Always Sunny? The implication of Dennis.
Dennis, yeah.
You know, like, boats are a good move to make moves on a lady because you're out there in the middle of the ocean. You're so far away. No one can see or hear. There's an implication. Well, what's the implication, Dennis? You know, like, I feel like the Homelander, the implication is like, yeah, well, you could say no and he could burn your eyes out of the socket. So can you say no?
Yeah. I mean, you're definitely right with what we know about him. I feel like his public image is such that people wouldn't necessarily be afraid to say no to him.
Yeah, like imagine a groupie at a Homelander show that wants to, for whatever reason, bone down on Homelander. That, I guess, would be a consensual relationship. But again, it's based on the fact that she doesn't know what she doesn't know.
Right.
So, and that he is lying. And so now you're going back to like, would she sleep with him knowing that he's a monster? Probably not, or at least most women wouldn't. So that it's like you're it's coercion all the way down when you're a demigod, you know?
Right.
You know, like Zeus. He shapeshifts into a swan and and fucks some woman. It's still rape, you know? Yeah, we all understand this, right? Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's our take. Like I said, I think they're being cagey about it, but I think it's because there's something not quite right about Ryan's parentage that they haven't let us know yet. Hmm. But I haven't really seen ahead of that, so this is not me, like, wink, wink. It's just me playing along. Paul, I want to add a little bit to the discussion of Homelander's racism by pointing out a motif or detail that I noticed. We see Homelander drinking an absolute ton of milk. Milk is something of a big deal in white supremacist circles for several reasons. First, white people are generally much more likely to retain lactose tolerance than most people of colors. I did not.
Not me.
I knew. Okay. So I knew that the white milk was a thing about in the far right kind of racist contingent, because they're all like posing with milk all the time and all that kind of stuff. But I didn't know the ins and outs. But I looked into this and supposedly it's true. Like Asians, especially, far less lactose tolerant on average than European stock. You from European stock are lactose intolerant. So. Mm-hmm. I guess you're the gym that proves the rule.
Yeah.
Additionally, milk is often used as a metaphor for race mixing because it's a pure white substance. And if you put even a drop of something dark in it, you supposedly ruin the drink. No one tell them about chocolate milk. Yeah, right? You know?
Uh-huh.
I think there might be other reasons for this choice, like highlighting Homelander's mommy issues, but I thought it was an interesting thing to note.
I mean, the mommy issues are the number one thing there, but... Sure.
Yeah, but it would not surprise me at all if they kind of lean into that, you know, because it's like anytime you can do double duty and you can lift more than one plot point with a single thing, that's writing economy is what we're talking about right there. So that's all the feedback we got for the first couple episodes. If you would like to send us some more, you can do so easily by writing into DHS. Send us an email to DHS@baldmove.com. We will consider them, and there's a high degree of likelihood that we will read them and consider them on air. So DHS@baldmove.com, and that will wrap it up for this week's mailbag. But other than that, we'll be back for, are we on episode 5 already?
Sure.
Well, getting off of this, the first 3 episodes, fast starts, like, boy, we're already at the halfway point and over.
Yeah.
Two weeks into this thing, but we got four weeks, the back half, the back 9, the back 4 waiting for us. Hope you return and join us for next week. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.